G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 269th, Tidying Up. My name's Dick Newman. Let's get on with it. Yeah, Henry Purcell, he's sadly leaving us. He's going to be dead about now. Just to get us underway. Last week, it was all about Charles dying, wasn't it? What did you make of our banger-in-chief? He was mainly interested in peace and quiet, which gets a big tick from me. He was obviously into the babes, and apart from the unfortunate Lucy Walter, he treated the ladies pretty well. It was more than just sex for Charles. He liked women. If we compare Charles and Catherine of Braganza with Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, we may not think too harshly on Charles and his relationship with his missus. He was a dashing warrior in his young days, and his escape from England was a decent adventure. In exile, he behaved about as well as can be expected. His over-enthusiastic flexibility in politics didn't help him at all. We saw the usual squabbles with courtiers and those he ditched, particularly Anthony Cooper, Earl of Shaftesbury, turned into rather annoying enemies. Parliament didn't cover itself with glory, and the Whigs' experiment so far has been a total dud. Different guys cobbled together with different ideas is always tricky. They failed to come up with positive ideas and drove Charles to Louis XIV to provide Charles with pocket money. We can hardly say that Charles left a well-organised government behind, but people just kept on attacking him. Okay. Time to tidy up some of our players, even though you really want to know if it'll be York or Monmouth as the next king. Hang on, we'll get there. Henry German had got St. James Square finished with St. James Church built by Christopher Wren. It was designed to be like a big palace with a big courtyard, a symbol of the king's magnificence. It was Parliament pushing Charles towards Louis that got Henry German recalled to do some diplomatic stuff. Goodbye retirement for Henry. Henry helped with a deal, then waited for his reward from Louis, and waited, and then told the ambassador in France to tell Louis that a token of gratitude would be appropriate. Louis had a diamond-studded box lying around, so that'll go to Henry German. Henry's eyesight is failing, but he's surrounded by nephews and Frenchy friends like Hortense Mancini. 1684, and we get that freezing winter in England. The Thames is frozen over for the first time in nobody knows how long. Charles had even gone out to have a look at the spectacle of a whole ox being roasted over a fire in the middle of the Thames. 2nd of January, 1684, age 78. Oh, that's good, isn't it? Henry German, the young champion of Queen Henrietta Maria, will die. Henry could have scored a spot at Westminster, but he wanted to be buried in his family spot at Rushbrook. Henry German, of course, had no kiddies, unless Charles was a kiddie of his, but one of his nephews had a few famous descendants. One of these will be Bear Grylls, drinker of his own pee. Henry's sister also had a descendant who was a poet, Lord Byron. Another descendant of the German family was Horatio Nelson, who ended up in Tom Wolsey's coffin in St. Paul's. So there you go, we say goodbye to Henry German. George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, is still alive, but he won't be troubling us anymore. After his playing around with politics, he ended up against the Whigs because he didn't like Anthony Cooper or Monmouth. He's retired and will get a runny nose in a couple of years and die. Thankfully, no kiddies, and there's no more George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham's for us. Not alive anymore, he's also Charles's cousin Rupert. Rupert died in 1682 from pleurisy. 62, so not bad for the time. Rupert had never married. It was just mistresses for him. His actress mistress, Margaret Hughes, who didn't mind having at least one of the girlish charms on display for a portrait, did no good. She was a heavy gambler. Just one kiddie from this woman, a girl, Rupetta. He also had a son earlier, but he was killed in the lowlands trying to belt up whoever it was we wanted belted up at the time. For a guy who won bugger all battles, Rupert is considered to be a famous warrior. Back to Charlie's angels, or really first women. I thought we might just talk about women. I'll probably do a special, I think, because in the US, in certain states, women's rights have just been removed. We'd like the women back in their boxes, please. The prevailing sexual theology, as set down by Gregory the Great, says that banging is all well and good, so long as you don't enjoy it. It only becomes a sin if you start having a good time. It's even worse if the woman consents to sex. Oh dear, I think our lady listeners have decided not to be fans of Greg the Great. Greg is sprouting modern day heresy. Women, as we know, have copped a hard time. Our best king ever, Arthur, had to put up with his half-sister Morgan Le Fay seducing him, and his missus Guinevere went off to bang his best mate Lancelot. Fucking women. For men, the view is that we lust after some chicky babe, which makes us hate ourselves. Well, don't fall for that bullshit, gentlemen listeners. It looks like we dominate women, and yes, it surely does look that way. But the reality is, if we open our eyes, it's we poor men that have been enslaved by these vile but very hot creatures. I may have painted a bit of a rosy picture for women during the restoration of Charles. But really, apart from they're allowed to be hairdressers, they're allowed to be actresses and so on, it's not that good. Writing has changed. We've been portraying women as virtuous and love has been idolised to be something rather marvellous. Now it's just fucking with no romance and it's the man who gets ensnared. Women are castigated for usurping men who are the ones who should have the sexual power. Women just fuck us and dump us and we aren't happy. May a stinking vapour choke your womb, such as the men who dote upon. May your depraved appetite, that could in whiffling fool's delight, beget such frenzies in your mind. You may go mad for the north wind and fixing all your hopes upon it, to have him bluster in your cunt. Turn up your longing ass the air and perish in a wild despair. Yeah, see, there's not much there about chivalrous knights and a virtuous fair maiden, is there? Conservative people were in despair about the degeneration of society. They usually are. We had a lot of women displaced by the Civil War, which also created a lot of widows. They found themselves suddenly broken out in the street and had to work out how to survive. One obvious solution was to look for a protector, as Lucy Walter had. There were plenty more where Lucy came from, and lots of them will just disappear. They may be kept until they became pregnant or their new lover just got tired of them. They'll struggle to keep their looks and learn the art of seduction. Some went for, oh no, they went for abortions, and that's very fucking dangerous at this time. They suffered tongue lashings from rivals or people who hadn't been affected by the war. Some women, though, did cop a break. With a shortage of men, they became business people or estate managers. Bess of Hardwick's great-grandson, Charles Cavendish, married Margaret Lucas. She was a lady to old Queen Mary. The public will take away their lands and the Cavendishes are deep in debt. Margaret will copy Bess in the legal battle stuff. She was one of those people who wasn't into the word impossible. She turned into a writer who was published. Poems, plays, essays, philosophy, no subject was off limits. Learned men will be annoyed. Of course I will. She's poaching their business. We don't like these women coming here and taking our jobs. She will want to visit the Royal Society, which will cause a huge debate as to whether a girlie should be allowed just to visit. She'll get in. She doesn't take no for an answer. No, she actually wrote them a very good letter. With our actresses, life did give us Elizabeth Barry, who could do both tragedy and comedy. She'll become a star, and she will earn more than the men. She'll become a bit of an early shop steward as well, standing up to the shareholders to ensure that the workers were all getting a fair deal. Elizabeth will have affairs with courtiers, but stay devoted to acting. Eventually, she will lead a breakaway group to form her own company. That's promising, isn't it? One way or another, there's a bit of a feminist revolution going on. Those various factions that formed also found women getting involved. We get female prophets, and they can say, hey, didn't God raise Gloriana Queen Betty to be the sword bearer against the filthy Catholic Spanish field? Give up your stupid legal arguments that women need to be quiet and obey men. Eleanor Touche may go a little bit too far in Lichfield Cathedral, saying she's the head of the church in England. Yeah, too much too soon, Eleanor, so she'll be in the slammer. But it's caught on, and women are starting to do the prophesying all over England. Eleanor Touche, by the way, turned out to be wrong that the world would end in 19 and a half years' time. The Baptists are finding women in their flock who want to be magicians or hold separate girl-only magic shows. No, we can't have that either. It's too much with the religious stuff. We also got the Quaker movement, and that one was really made possible by the female Quakers. We're finding women preaching anyway, with or without churchy approval. We find women missionaries, and women are starting to share in local government. Back to those Quakers who will remove the obey part of the marriage ceremony on the basis that we all, male and female, only obey God, not some husband. Reformers are pushing for stuff like divorce for loveless marriages or marriages that were made for financial or political gain. With this type of empowerment going on, women want to take charge of their sexuality. Adultery's going pretty strongly, and the church is under attack for failing women. Oh, good stuff there. You churchy types want monogamous relationships, but you insist on a patriarchal society where women have no rights. Oh yes, divorce might be starting, but right now, only men can ask for a divorce. We also got a push for female nudity. Well, it shows in the artwork, doesn't it? It will outlaw the titillation of low-cut dresses. Yeah, so women are making the fair point that if they have their girlish charms on display all the time, then men will eventually stop sexualising them. It'll just become normal. Whitehall Chapel, and a young woman will get her kit off and streak through the chapel yelling out, "Welcome to the resurrection." It might be just a look at me moment rather than a holy moment, I don't know. There's also a push for polygamy, but that one again is a man's idea. The plan then is that men can have three wives, but women can have one husband. We can settle a lot of this stuff down, though, because there is nothing vaguely like income equality. That explains how guys like Charles scored lots of hot chicks. Sorry to say, a lot of that was about living a life of luxury rather than how marvellous and hot Charles was. Sexuality is being examined in England like never before. Margaret Cavendish will write a book where a man proposes to a woman, pledging undying devotion and fidelity. "Sure," says the woman, "those are nice words, but I want it in writing, and I want a condition that if you break your vows, I can break mine." Sure enough, he'll soon be off on a bit of adultery, and off she goes too. Now, where am I going with all this? I guess it's that after the Puritan austerity, we probably went maybe a bit too fast the other way, and that some women found a need to use sex to gain protection, while others showed once again that women are capable of doing things that are thought to be men-only type things. This was no real sexual revolution, though, and I'm supposed to be doing a tidy-up and a goodbye to Charles, really, so let's get back to that. This isle was well-reformed and gained renown while brave Tudors wore the imperial crown. But since the ill-got race of Stuarts came, it has recoiled to popery and shame. Misguided monarchs, rarely wise or just, tainted with pride or impetuous lust. Yeah, it was all great in the good old days of the Tudors. For Charles, he was seen as giving up royal power to women, which made him, in the eyes, weak, effeminate, sterile, and, homosexual. Sterile seems a bit unfair, but it refers to his fail in getting an heir to the big chair. As for homosexual, well, we haven't had anybody doing any sort of study into sexuality, so our ideas are still what we in the 21st century might call a bit odd. Charles grew up as a fairy tale prince, only to be tossed out into the real world. That put him more in touch with ordinary people, more than most princes. He had to grow up fast in a war zone where he was a target. His dad's ideas of being a sort of divine human were discarded by Charles. His mum, fortunately, was a bit pragmatic. With his laziness at kingly work, it could be just that he was sick of squabbling courtiers who all wanted him to be their ideal of a king. Easier just to delegate the work to Hyde. Charles seems to have respected people with principles, but yeah, maybe he himself didn't have any. The nature of the king's court was problematic for courtiers, ambassadors, or anyone on business to the king. They had to flatter his women, give them dinner parties and bribe them, or whatever. It was humiliating for some of these guys. We saw lots of shake-ups in his ministry, and often it was some mistress or other who may have helped bring about that downfall. But Charles was loyal to the women. To Catherine, who failed in the heir department, Babs and Louise, who really took him for a ton of cash, and with Babs, he put up with a lot of bullying. Louise was hugely unpopular with the mob, and Nell was a little bit vulgar. With women in general getting uppity out in England, the women were obvious targets for people, but Charles stuck by them. Okay, back to tidying up. Nell Gwynne will have a stroke shortly, only 37. Then another stroke, then death from apoplexy, leading modern medical types to say it was syphilis that killed her. Live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse. Next, we turn to the gossip magazines for a very gossipy story about Barbara Palmer, Duchess of Cleveland. Ready for a complicated sort of tale? Babs will remarry. Roger Palmer had died when Babs was 61, so, yeah, she was after a new husband. Guy by the name of Robert Fielding, and it looks like each one married the other for money. But the whole thing's going to backfire. Robert had been chasing wealthy widows. He'd had a peek at the will of the late husband of Anne de Lau. Anne had scored £60,000 and Robert wanted it. While he was courting Babs, he was also writing love letters to Anne, but Anne's servants knew what Robert was about, so they hid the letters. Robert went to Anne's hairdresser, Charlotte Villers, with a bribe of £500 to get him married to Anne. But Charlotte wasn't born yesterday, so she did arrange a marriage between Robert and a poor widow, Mary Wadsworth, who Robert thought was Anne. Complicated, is it not? Two more things then happened in rapid succession. Robert also married our Babs, then found out he hadn't married rich Anne, he'd married broke Mary. Having married Robert, Babs also found out he was a total prick and just after a cash. Now, I know what you want to know in all this. Who is Robert Rogery? Well, I can tell you. He's actually giving Charlotte Calvert a darn good rogering. Okay, who's this Charlotte Calvert I've just tossed into the story? Well, she is the granddaughter of Charles and Babs. Charlotte then will be up the spout and Robert in the Old Bailey on bigamy charges. Well, he's guilty, of course, so his marriage to Babs will be annulled. He'll get the benefit of clergy to avoid any penalty. Yes, that benefit of clergy thing won't be abolished for about 150 years, and oddly enough, it only applies to upper-class men. While Robert will continue rogering around for the rest of his life, his marriage to broke Mary, oddly enough, will stick. 7 years later, 68-year-old Babs will die from heart failure. Now, Louise de Keruel stayed unpopular in England, so went back to France. She'll return a couple of times, but way in the future for some English silly behattings. She'll be broke, having gambled away enough cash for you and I to live 100 happy lifetimes. Creditors will be forever chasing her, but eventually the regent to Louis XV, that's Philtou, Duke of Orléans, will protect her and provide her with pocket money. Louise will end up dying aged 85. Queen Catherine will hang out in England for about 7 years, mainly down to a chasing Hyde Jr. in a lawsuit over some cash. But the English aren't totally over hating Catholics, so it'll be a hard time, then back to Portugal for Catherine. She will promote England in Portugal, helping with treaties. She'll also spend a bit of time there as regent. Catherine will be remembered for making tea fashionable in England and giving the Poms Bombay. She'll die at 67. Frances Stuart, the one that got away, retired from court to the country and just died at 55. Hortense Mancini will hang out in England. Fair enough, given that her husband is a total tool. After Charles died, she was, of course, reduced in social status. She will preside over a salon for intellectuals, and it will be the most celebrated place for big brains in Europe. Women will be allowed in, and we'll see both Babs and Nell Gwynn coming in to learn stuff. It will also be the place where the new drink, champagne, will be introduced to England. The real champagne comes to us from grapes originally planted by the Romans in the county of Champagne. One of the most famous is Dom Perignon, named after the monk Dom Perignon. The local abbey had been destroyed in that war of a religion. It got rebuilt, and part of the local ties was grapes. Dom Perignon had a fiddle with the grapes, and the rest is history. Back to Hortense, who actually herself preferred spirits to champagne, and so will drink herself to death, age 53. Worse ways to go than that, I guess. Moll Davis, actress who had Charles's last bastard, Mary Tudor, failed in a battle against the clever Nell Gwynn. She fell from favour, but did score a rather nice house. She married Frenchy composer Jacques Pisbel. Yeah, that's what he sounded like. He'll change his name to James Paisible, get a job for the Duke of York, then the happy couple will go to France when the smart Catholics are getting out of town, then come back to England again once we regain our sanity. Moll will die at 60. Her daughter, Mary Tudor, might be a countess, but she'll follow in Mum's footsteps and become an actress. Now I think we should get Charles buried. Oh, woe is us, the king is dead. He'll lay in state in the palace for a few days. A wax effigy will be made. Queen Catherine knows how to act and will receive ambassadors and the big dicks who want to give their sympathy. Charlie's angels are allowed to wear black, but their households aren't allowed to go into mourning. That's for important people only. Charles can be popped into a lead coffin, and then we're off to Westminster Abbey, the Henry VII Chapel. Look down if you want to see where he is. Yeah, look, it was small-scale funeral, then we just popped Charles into a hole. No tomb of magnificence for our converted to Catholic chuck, and besides, we can't afford anything. It's actually become a habit that we bury important people at night, and close relatives don't attend. Handy for James, Duke of York, he can stay away. Dukes of Somerset and Beaufort will be there with a piddly 16 earls. Charles had also died deep in debt, so, yeah, there's no money for a big show. Bit of a contrast to Cromwell's huge funeral that cost £50,000. Okay, let's go sailing. Yeah, we're joining the Pet Shop Boys to go west. And if you go west from England, you're going to get to Gilead, where we can catch up on our regicides Wally and Gough, who smartly went there. £100 bounty on each of them must have been pretty darn tempting. The governor, though, will say nothing will happen to them so long as there was no formal request from England. It's a colony that would prefer to just get along without English interference. Their charter allows them to kind of set their own legislation, so long as it doesn't contradict English law. Massachusetts had managed to sail through the English Civil War without the need to take sides. Parliament hadn't bothered looking at their charter, and for Massachusetts, any new legislation coming from that republic was just put into their own legislation, so long as the colony saw it as an advantage. Charles had calmed down by this time from that killing frenzy of the regicides, so really, he just saw America as a potential income earner. A guy will turn up from the colony, though, and get all worked up about the filthy governor protecting Wally and Gough. The government response will be moderate. It'll be a polite letter to the colony about how we want to be good buddies with you guys, and Wally and Gough aren't even mentioned. Even so, the colony will have a chat about, do you think we should arrest these two guys and send them as a nice present to Charles? It will go to a court with the answer being, no. We want to stay as independent as we can from England. Even so, our two guys will see that their position isn't totally safe, so they are off to New Haven, about 150 miles away. New Haven was a Puritan settlement and well away from Boston, which would be the first place the English authorities would look if they turned up. New Haven was also against the restoration of Charles. New Haven has also not been issued a charter, nor was it likely they'd get one. They're operating in a totally independent manner. Next, one of the leading figures in New Haven was a guy who had made the crossing with Wally and Gough, and he liked them. Their preacher-in-chief had also made a stirring sermon about hiding the outcasts. All good for our regicides. Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Yeah, if I've ever entertained an angel, I am totally unaware. As it turns out, the move was a good idea. Just as they arrived at New Haven, Massachusetts decided to issue a warrant for their arrest. Yeah, but they're 150 miles away with a bloody big forest in between and it's winter. Nobody wants to play chasey. It may also be that the government can let England know they've issued the warrants. In comes a letter from England saying, yeah, we want them arrested and sent here. Thanks, guys. The letter did cause some worry, not about the regicides. It was about who it was addressed to. It was addressed to our trusty and well-beloved, the present governor of New England. Hang on a tick, say our Americans, there is no fucking governor of New England. Could it be that England's intending to put in some overall governor of the Americas? We don't want that. On the other hand, because that guy doesn't exist, we can also just sit on the letter, while perhaps slipping a message to New Haven saying, hey, things might be heating up, guys. Off go our guys to a different house. William Jones, whose dad had been executed as a regicide. 2 days later, after they'd left, a warrant turns up to their last address. The warrants had been issued by the governor of Massachusetts on his own, which is naughty. He's supposed to get the council to tick off on it, but he hadn't asked the council. May help explain why his guys were a bit slow getting to the place where our guys had just left. In fact, though, the governor might be helping them still by suggesting they had gone to New Holland under the Dutchy governor, Peter Stuyvesant.
Peter Stuyvesant, the international passport to smoking pleasure.
The governor will even write to Peter Stuyvesant asking him to apprehend the guys. The governor had sent two guys to track down the regicides and they'll meet delays everywhere. Nobody's providing active support and the various governors round the place will look at their commission that says to the governor of New England and say, listen guys, you know there's no governor of New England, so your commission is no good. And they get further delays because we won't help them on the Sabbath and all this means plenty of time for the fugitives to keep on the run. Each time these guys go to a new place, the guys chasing them have to get a new warrant from the local magistrate. Magistrates will make sure they're out for a few hours or delay in other ways. It's clear that our colonies do not like English interference. Eventually, some magistrates will meet and issue warrants, but they knew that by now Wally and Gough were gone. Off go our regicide hunters to New Neverland, and Peter Stuyvesant will organise a search. That's no good, our guys aren't there. The Massachusetts Bay General Court will allocate our hunters 250 acres, where they will go to live and give up regicide hunting. Wally and Gough don't know that, so they're still on the run. They look like they've run out of houses to stay in, so they're in a cave in Virginia, and there's lots of predators there. Reports, of course, go to London, and there's just too many hiccups and delays for it not to be willful behaviour by the colony. They're not trying to take these guys into custody, it's plain. Even though the reports are sure of serious attempts to apprehend the villains. The colony's also dragging its feet on declaring Charles as king. In light of unhappy letters from England, our colonialists will strive to be fair dinkum in finding the lads. They need to be seen as loyal. Strongly worded letters go to New Haven, and for those guys, Charles could actually just take away all their land. They'd actually bought it from the locals rather than getting a grant from the government. Yeah, see, they did the right thing, which is the wrong thing. Yeah, that's how it works. After buying the land and moving there, they'd try to get a patent for the place, but it didn't happen. Their legal status is just squatters. Worse, it hasn't been going well. People haven't been turning up to increase the population. A trading post was established and failed. Exports to England have failed, and both the locals and the duchies could stage a takeover. Their court will write back saying, hey, look, our efforts weren't that good, but it's not disloyalty to the king. It may have been better if you guys had sent the correct commission in the first place rather than some dud document talking about the governor of New England. Besides, they haven't always been in New Haven, and you guys also failed to arrest them. Lastly, just remember this. Remember this. We're not actually hiding them. Well, that last one might have been a bit of a fib. Even so, it's not the biggest problem Charles has, so the thing will die down. Wally and Gough will come out of the cave and spend a couple of years with a friendly colonial. Meanwhile, the authorities can rewrite their history saying how hard they had worked on those arrests. We did all we could is the theme, and those accounts will go to England. Bits and pieces of letter writing will occur so our regicides get news from England. Not happy news, Miles Corbett and Charles Barks dead, captured in Holland, extradited, hung, drawn and quartered. John Oakey, captured in Germany, likewise got the torture death. Irishman and Republican Sir George Downing had turned royalist and regicide hunter. I say Irish, but he was raised in Boston and graduated at Harvard. Downing Street in London is named after this guy. That's now 2 years after the Restoration and we're still killing people. In a couple of years, Downing will get John Lyle assassinated in Switzerland, but America is a lot farther away for Downing. In comes the news of the Act of Uniformity, making all Americans a bit unhappy, except for the odd Anglican here and there. The information getting to England on Wally and Gough is both obscure and inaccurate. Even so, it'll be a personal letter from Charles to remind the Americans that he wants these guys. 4 years after the Restoration, and we'll get a commission in, or four royal commissioners to go to New England and New Amsterdam to get the buggers. Sounds like our regicides are in for it, but perhaps not. It's actually a minor part of a bigger brief, and the wording makes it sound unimportant. Still, those colonials know we're fair dinkum. It'll be four warships and 400 soldiers turning up with those commissioners. That looks hard, but the commissioners had also been told to tread lightly. We want to gently turn the Americans back to being totally loyal English. American products have also become more important, so we want trade to go on. And just tell those Americans all they have to do is use the Book of Common Prayer in their magic show and be good Anglicans. Trade and religion are more important than a couple of fugitives. The Americas were worried about this visit. They're supposed to be autonomous, so why does England keep interfering? Could Charles be about to revoke their charter? Big relief when we find out that's not on the cards, but the commissioners will be those classic hard-ass dickheads we so often see in the movies. There's a reason we so often see them in the movies, because they are hard-ass dickheads. But the commissioners are playing away while the Americans are on home ground, so the Americans will run rings around them. The commissioners are dead and will go home. Charles will order agents from America to come in for a little chat, and the colonialists will just ignore him. Meanwhile, Wally and Gulf had gone back to their cave, only for about 10 days. While those commissioners had failed to nab them, they did take retribution on a guy who had helped them out. His cattle will be gone. After that, the colonialists stood up to the commissioners. "Hey, guys, the charter says we pay 20% tax to the king, and that allows us to do our own thing. Our only obligation apart from tax is to be polite. And this stuff you've heard about us helping the regicides is fake news." But oh dear, some locals have found the cave with Wally and Gough stuff in it. Surely the news will spread, so they're off again. They'll turn up in Hadley, about 90 miles away from Boston, and they'll meet John Dixwell, fellow regicide. He's okay. He's living under an assumed name, and the English think he's dead. They won't be teaming up. And in England, we get the plague. For the Americans, this is definitely from God, because the naughty English aren't Puritans. We all need to repent and toss off anything English that is naughty, otherwise God will fuck us up too. Part of this is that we need to protect our holy regicides. Next year, and God totally proves he's pissed off with the Anglicans by giving us the Great Fire of London. Next year, regicide hunter-in-chief Hyde is out of government. Things will calm down so much that Wally and Gough could probably go home, as long as they lead a life with a low profile. But in comes that religious repression to England, so they won't be thinking of going home at all. 1675, and Wally's in his 70s. He's spent about 15 years on the run, and that's enough for him. He's dead. But that's got us back to 1675, when Charles still had 10 years to live, and in America, it's the second generation of colonials, so time for them to go to war. It is America, after all. This will be King Philip's War, so you're expecting Spaniards in the works. But no, this is not a Spanish film. It's the name we use for Wampanoag, Chief Metacom. Obviously, he failed to trademark the name Metacom, which is a corporation. Metacom designs and builds solutions specifically to solve the unique needs and requirements of our clients. We deliver to a variety of clients, ranging from large multinational retailers, quick service restaurants, financial service providers, forecourts, lot providers, and corporates. Because the Americans knew a corporation would want the name Metacom, they called Metacom Phil. Wampanoags, Nipmunks and Narragansetts had all decided they were over the pond, so in they came. These guys were pretty brutal, as humans can be, so you can expect torture, rape, being flayed, scalped, beheaded, your house can be burned, your livestock slaughtered, all the usual stuff. Wait till they find out how brutal the ponds can be. About 2,000 New Englanders will die. 50 towns attacked, with 12 just totally gone. The cost of that war will be around £250,000, and in those days, Americans couldn't just pop it on the credit card, so their economy is stuffed. And that caused me to bring up the website for the US debt clock. Those numbers are spinning like crazy right now. Well, they're always spinning like crazy. But let's have an easy number. Debt per citizen, 91,670. Meaning all those unwanted babies that will now be born with the reversal of Roe v. Wade will start their financial lives owing $91,670. We did have a look at the US debt clock back in the money special, 2.5 years ago, when every American owed $70,000. So in 2.5 years, every American has borrowed another $20,000 and spent it on, did you guess, mainly bangy stuff? Yeah, mainly bangy stuff. Last time we also had a look to see what would happen if you took out all the babies and unemployed people and whoever, and just had a look at how much each taxpayer owes. That would be 187,000 2.5 years ago, And now, where is it per taxpayer? Debt per taxpayer today, $242,986. So if the US government actually said today, look, everybody, we need to pay off our national debt, could all taxpayers please give us $242,986? You'd find a revolution. None of that matters to our colonialists because they don't owe a cracker in debt, but their economy is fucked.
I hear babies crying. I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Yes, it is a wonderful world, my dear listener, and to prove it, we're going to have a miracle. The miracle of Hadley. The local Indigenous people attacked while we were in the Baby Jesus clubhouse all doing a nice bit of praying. That's a bit rude of them, isn't it? People were confused, but an elderly gentleman appeared and said, "Follow me out of the clubhouse so we can fuck over these filthy savages." Having led the congregation out to battle, he disappeared. There you go, genuine miracle. For about 200 years. Then some cracks were spotted in the story, mainly that the date was totally wrong. Wrong date, but yeah, the miracle still happened. Probably not, but it could be that our still-in-hiding goth may have popped into a church to warn people that an attack was starting. The English had sent Edward Randolph as colonial administrator to help out with the local wars. You'd think the English were overlooking for Gough, but Randolph was still a bit keen. Gough will narrowly escape capture once again. Randolph, having missed Gough, will, like guys before him, have a go at the authorities. Once again, they'll say, "Look, mate, we tried really hard, but it's a big place, and we can't spend endless time checking every little bit of that big space." Randolph will keep trying for a few years, but we can see from his correspondence with England that the Poms don't really care anymore. But there is the odd colonialist who's interested. 1680, and a new guy from England, John London, will spot Gough at the house of John Bull. London will say he's planning to kidnap Gough, but it will be London who is kidnapped and taken to the authorities. He'll be accused of conspiracy against the colony. Now that guy London will slip away and go to the English military. How colonialists are back to worrying that a Governor-General will be appointed to America. Gough will be told if that happens, he should really piss off. The Governor of Massachusetts will now actively go after Gough as a token to England about how loyal we are. But it actually looks a bit more like play-acting for England because our second regicide has just died. Yeah, Gough's dead, so good time to ramp up investigations with suitable reports to England. Why ever have I told you all this? I guess it was to illustrate the delicate balance between the colony and their masters in England. We can see that they are keen as mustard to be independent from England, but the economics don't allow it. They're reliant on England for goods in and reliant on England to sell their produce to. Even though they're reliant on England, we can see that they were pretty solidly giving the finger to England in respect to the two regicides. There may have been a fair amount of luck involved as well. As we know, Charles, he was more interested in hot chicks than chasing down Wally and Gough. If he really wanted them, he could have sent a bunch of guys to America with a firm brief. Our colonialists are stubborn and jealous of their autonomy, and they're separated from the government by 3,000 miles of ocean. That's handy. Continuing the tidy up, we'll briefly turn to the East India Company, who, believe it or not, are up to shitfuckery. Who would have thought a corporation would behave badly? Maybe they aren't if we compare them to the 21st century marvellous Western democratic countries. If that isn't a big enough clue about what they're doing, it's paying off MPs. Yes, the East India Company have found out that bribery is good. For us, it's called campaign donations. With a recent case in the US Supreme Court relating to that wonderful Senator Ted Cruz, and that case has just been decided. That goes to campaign donations made after the election has been decided. You see, in the US, a candidate can lend themselves money to run. Then after the election, a donor can give the successful candidate cash to repay himself. Only an august body such as the US Supreme Court could rule that this action is totally cool and it's a benefit to democracy. Back to the East India Company, and their method is to issue free shares to prominent MPs. Big mobs of shares for positions like Solicitor General and Attorney General. It's the world's very first corporate scandal, although finding out about it will take a few years. Investigations into that scandal will lead to the discovery that the company is also into insider trading and further general bribery. The Lord President of the Council will be impeached and the company's governor can go into the slammer. Perhaps then the government back then was better than our own in respect to corporate crime. 1681 and we got a new Turk in the company, Sir Josiah Child. Self-made man who is aggressive and he wants more money. Of course he does. This dickhead will decide to take on the Mughals because he's definitely not studied history or culture or India. The Mughals did stay anti-English. They allowed trade, but they screw us as hard as they can, and Sir Josiah has decided to teach them a lesson. Off go 19 warships with 200 cannon and 600 soldiers. The Mughal would have more firepower in his personal guard than that. Let's check in on the morale of the Mughal. Well, he's just knocked over the Sultanate of Bijapur and the Sultanate of Golconda, which was no mean feat, and at the same time pushed the Marathas back to the hills where they came from. He's just emerged as an unrivalled regional power, and now England has sent a fleet to attack him. In come our brave English boys, and the Mughal will just swat them like flies. They didn't get past the beach. English assets are seized and plundered. English are booted out of Bengal, and our new toy Bombay is blockaded. The company will have to say they're very, very, very sorry, and please can we have our toys back? And can we also get the release of the English prisoners? We know you like to make them wander around the streets in chains, and you like to starve them and keep them in rat-infested health holes, but we would really like them back. It's going to take 9 years of grovelling before the Mughal says, "Oh, all right." Okay, that was a quick update then. All this updating, though, has got me back to thinking about our honest lawyer, John Cook. So my podcast means I can think out loud to you, my dear listener. The next bit of king killing after Charles I will be Louis XIV in France. No, fuck, Louis XVI. What am I talking about? Louis XIV, he's going to live forever. Louis XVI's dickhead lawyers will say, "Copy Charles," and tell the court they have no jurisdiction. Louis, though, will say, "Nah, I want to prove I'm innocent." Louis won't be given a chance to prove anything. The National Assembly will pass the Frenchy version of a bill of attainder, so it was just a matter of a vote to have him beheaded. Close vote, as it turned out. Tom Paine, that hero of the USA, was an honorary member of the Assembly and said, "Send Louis to the USA where they can teach him about how great it is to love democracy." Tom Paine will then be accused of being a filthy Puritan. Yeah, attack the man, not the argument. Robespierre will say, "We can't pardon a mass murdering despot," and Louis's done. To make sure he can't do a Charles I speech at his execution, they'll have lots of drummers drumming around, drumming their bloody dingers off. Yeah, making lots of noise so nobody can hear Louis. After World War I, the English will have their next crack at king killing. That will be Kaiser Bill of Germany, who lost that war. It will be the USA that say no to that. International law set by the Treaty of Westphalia. Remember that treaty that ended the 30 Years' War? Anyway, it prohibited king killing. Kaiser Bill will be a guest of the duchies for the rest of his life. World War II, 1945, and the English are wondering about Nazi trials and looking back at the Charles I stuff. For Churchill, it was about Sir George Downing, who in this very episode managed to get exiled regicides dead, Hokey, Barkstead and Corbett. So Churchill thought that was a great idea and wanted to send out hit squads to locate, identify and assassinate Nazis. Once again, the USA stepped in and said, "No way. You can't go around just killing Nazis. It's not like they're Osama bin Laden or Iranian nuclear physicists or Palestinian reporters. No, the American people couldn't face the shame of just killing people like that. We have to deal with them fairly and make a record of our reasons and motives for going after them." We hit a deadlock, so Stalin got in on the game with a deciding vote. There was nothing Stalin liked more than a show trial with the accused ending up dead, so trial it was. And that gave us a brand new jurisdiction, international criminal law. Chief captive of the Nazis was Goering. Like John Cook before him, he had handy advice for his fellow Nazi prisoners. "When you get before the judges, just say these three words, 'Kiss my ass.'" Yeah, that was his advice. But what will happen is the squeakiest clean trials we can manage. The Americans got their way, ensuring that the trials were beyond criticism. Goering will escape the noose by taking poison. The US will go after the Japanese after World War II and use Cook's principle of command responsibility for Japanese generals. Stalin will get away with murdering 20 million people. Pol Pot will get away with his genocide. Idi Amin will likewise escape from prosecution. It'll be 1988 for the English to have another go with the arrest of General Pinochet in London. We're back to wondering about that sovereign immunity, but Pinochet will get off due to ill health. But we're thinking about it still, so around the turn of the century, we've come up with command responsibility trumping sovereign immunity for crimes against humanity. 2001, and Slobodan Milosevic will be the first head of state since Charles I to face a panel of judges. Slobodan will go for the "you're an illegal court" thing. It's never worked. English judge will go the opposite way that Bradshaw had done with Charles. He'll enter a plea of not guilty for Milosevic and appoint a legal team to assist Milosevic. Slobodan will just make political speeches over and over, and with the trial dragging on for 3 years, he'll just die in the slammer. Next to face a court for world leaders will be Saddam Hussein. "By what authority do you try me?" Oddly enough, in that case, Saddam had a point. The USA was way too impatient to wait for the UN to tick off on their invasion, so the actual invasion was illegal, and therefore Saddam was probably right. Having smashed the place up, the US put in the equivalent of a rump parliament. That parliament put in a High Court of Justice, which had the ability to hang Saddam for making war on his own people. The Shia-controlled parliament sacked two judges who were making noises about "we want a fair trial," and at the same time they removed Saddam's right to ask for clemency. "We want a guilty verdict and we want the sentence to be death before we even start." The government will tell the judges to get on with it and get Saddam to the gallows, and the court will do just that. There will be, unfortunately, a video made of the execution made on phones that really proved the point. There was no justice there. I'm not saying that a fair trial would have found this arsehole innocent, just that the trial was a sham. Why not spend a couple of months more to tick all the boxes as the US had done with the Nazis? Meanwhile, in our times, there are plenty more despotic tyrants running countries around the world. Tyranny is not a criminal offence. The overthrow of Saddam Hussein was ethically right and legally terrible. We still haven't learned enough from John Cook. But you and I are finished finally with John, and we want a king. It's Jim, of course. But which Jim, you ask? Catholic York or Protestant bastard Monmouth? The winner will be Catholic York. Just what we wanted. So, well, we've still got a little bit of time, so let's get on with the backstory. 14th of October, 1633, a boy, James. Nice. That's fair air. Duke of York, and he'll also be Duke of Albany in Scotland, as a handy reminder that we are all just one big bunch of happy people, even if some people, like Scotties, don't have quite the same rights as we superior English people. The royal family, though, is a happy family, even though it seems the kiddies were more fond of Dad Charles than Mum Henrietta Maria. James will get a similar education as Big Brother Charles. He plays the guitar and dances, and he's learned French and a bit of Italian. He will become one of the founding members of the Royal Society, but he wasn't into it like Charles was. Yeah, James isn't necessarily that way inclined, academia and stuff. James will be more interested in the military than the book learning. He'll be 8 when he first sees an angry mob outside calling for Strafford to die. Okay, Strafford could die, but that didn't stop the angry mob. Queen Mary is off to France, and the royal kiddies are moved from Whitehall to St. James. Things are going downhill. Charles I is gearing up for war and wants the weapons stored in Hull. Parliament also wants those weapons. Charles will send 9-year-old James up to Hull for a chat with the governor. The governor will hang on to James for quite a while before sending him back to Dad. James will be with his big brother Charles at the first battle at Edgehill, where you may recall they were nearly captured. James won't be coming out for battle again. He can stay safely in Oxford for 3 years. We get to the bit when Prince Charles has to run away. Parliament will take James to London with the other royal kiddies. Earl of Northumbria will be looking after them. All of James' servants will be sacked and replaced with parliamentary servants. So he's there with Henry and Elizabeth and, oh, baby Henrietta. She's gone to France, hasn't she? His captivity isn't very tight and nobody's being strict or unfair to him, but he'll soon be thinking of escape. His dad is in the hands of the Scotties and brother Charles is in France. James is the nearest heir to the big chair, who is in custody of Parliament. He can hear the talk about deposing his dad and putting him in as a nice puppet. Dad will write to James saying, either come here to me or nick off to France. Parliament will find those letters and two of James's servants will be sacked. Then he'll get a runny nose and all thoughts of escape are gone. While he's unwell, Charles I is handed over to Parliament and Parliament is starting to blue with the new model army. The army will kidnap Charles and the royal kiddies are under closer security. The kiddies, though, will be allowed to visit Dad on a regular basis. Charles is talking up escape with James. Charles will escape himself to the Isle of Wight, then be recaptured and back in the slammer. More talk about James being a puppet king and he's playing hide and seek with his brother and sister. That wasn't frivolity. He was practicing. He's hiding and keeping very still and quiet. James will enlist Colonel Bampfield to help and he's off. Sneaky trip to London so he can get his best frock on and disguised as a woman, he'll be off on a barge with a few servants. James will pull up his skirt. You shouldn't pull up your skirt, James. No, he's pulled it up. And ask the colonel to help tie his garter, leading to the barge master becoming a bit suspicious that this is not a girl. It's all good. He turned out to be a royalist, so he'll even put his lights out so they can sneak along to meet a duchy ship. Off they go to be met by William of Orange, then on to The Hague and Sister Mary. That was a nice adventure for a 14-year-old. It's all joy and excitement. Then James will realise that, like his brother, he's a broke prince in exile. Parliament had kept him in luxury. We all know that it's welcome to the world of exiled courtiers all fighting with each other. England can go through its shitty times with the rump and then the trial and lastly the execution of King Charles. William of Orange can die again, leaving just the baby William of Orange in the lowlands. House of Orange will collapse. Stuart princes aren't welcome. Frenchies aren't that fussed on Stuart princes either, so that leaves Spain. Habsburgs aren't particularly fond of Stuarts either. Nobody likes them. Cromwell will go on the attack against the Spanish stuff in the New World, so Charles and James agree to go into Spanish service with English, Scotty and Irish exiles. We know how crappy it is, but we'll capture some English parliamentary ships, and James as Lord High Admiral is supposed to get 10% of that income. supposed to get and actually get are two different things, so disappointment for James. Like Charles, James got pocket money from the Frenchies, but also like Charles, the pocket money went first to Mum, Queen Mary, who took out her costs first before handing over what was left. James didn't have as many expenses as Charles, so he was okay. Then the lads went to Flanders and poverty again. Even so, for James, wine is cheap, and there are girlies who want to bag a bit of princely dick, so he's happy enough. Back to Paris, and there are plenty of banquets to attend, and the squabbles amongst the advisers. Some of these look to promote James as the next king, causing a nice bit of friction. Both lads have bad advisers, with the difference being Charles made his own decisions, while James just followed the bad advice. After the execution of Charles I, James formed his political views, and they aren't that good. He thought his dad had got done by being weak. A king should be a big bad bastard. He also couldn't see the different opposition's viewpoints. All opposition is bundled together and is subversive and republican. MPs who oppose the king are rebels. A rather large thing he's failed to see is the differences in religion. That has nothing to do with anything for James. He's obsessed with Republicans, who he thinks just want all Stuarts dead. He can't see that some of his dad's opponents were actually pro-royal. He thinks that any concessions made are a sign of weakness. He's into black and white, good and bad type thinking. If you're not with me, you're against me. That's exactly what got his dad dead. That will also put James in conflict with his mum. He's not a fan of Queen Mary. Oh, and look, now I'm over time. So that's where we'll leave it this week. Next week, James can find his happy place. That's in the army. Just a little bit of balalaika there to get us into some historical fiction. Balalaika to show support and solidarity with, I'm sure, many Russians who think, oh, Vlad, you shouldn't be killing people in Ukraine. But he is, so there you go. To get us into some historical fiction. And this week I did the last season of The Last Kingdom, where history was just tossed out the window. But they're not making a documentary, they're making a entertainment. But it wasn't that entertaining either. They decided they had to kill off a lot of characters, so it was kind of one a week. And I really was disappointed. Like Ethel fled, I thought they probably wouldn't give her the siege of Chester, where she was throwing the beehives and the hot beer at the Norse. But they could have given her Wodensfield and a mighty victory there. But no, we didn't do that. Ted the Elder was a total dick in the series. Yeah, I didn't find it that satisfying. As for reading, The Lion's Torment by Blanche DelPuget, book 3 in the Henry II series. I still haven't read book 1. Book 3 is the Tommy Beckett story, and Blanche did a great job, I reckon. This Tommy Beckett is nuts, like he's insane. And that insanity really ramps up at the end when he meets the knights that are going to kill him. But I really enjoyed this, and I'm looking forward to the next one, which is where we'll probably get the split between Henry and Eleanor. The Lion's Torment by Blanche DelPuget. Highly recommended. And it's a matter of what we're going out with, and I don't know, because I'm going to do one of those radio things and find out what Ukraine was listening to in the 1970s. So, whatever it is, hope you enjoy, and hope to see you next week. Bye.